The reading today is from the Reverend Nancy MacDonald Ladd. We gather in community every Sunday in a state of conflict for our very souls, a state both expansively hopeful and restrictively confined. We are hopeful that we might rise to meet a new day for those who seek and those who serve the Spirit, hopeful that each and every one of us might encounter the sacred within, among, and beyond every human being, and hopeful that such an encounter might work through us to topple the idolatries of our age. And yet, we also gather as people who are not yet free, a people confined, unfree, contained. We are confined, unfree, contained, because in this culture of division, built upon the pain of the people at the margins, even the decent people hold our love too tightly, putting it in boxes, prefacing it with qualifications. I will love you if, I will see you if, I will bear the truth of my soul alongside you, and only if you agree with me, you look like me, you stand like me, you think like me, you act like me, you sing like me, you wear your gender on your sleeve and produce it on demand. I will love you and will meet you in the sanctuary of our hearts if and only if you give me evidence of your good liberal virtue. If and only if you never fail to speak the language of the movement and never weep upon a street corner of grief for your sheer inadequacy and the vastness of the struggle that you cannot even name. We are imprisoned by these ifs and these only ifs. We are confined by the smallness of our loving, even as our souls remind us that we can only get free if we all get free together. And so today, as we intersect in honest work, let our hopefulness mingle with our conviction. Let our willingness to love beyond our expectations or experience break down our long-held barriers. Let our willingness to be honest about the hardest questions open us to new truths. May there truly be more love, with no labels and no binary and no preface and no qualification and no arithmetic and no limit. May there be more love to liberate us all. And may we keep on today and every day until we find it and share it inch by precious inch with one another and the world. So I invite you now into a time of shared silence for about 6 or 7 deep breaths. So I'll be going home in a couple of weeks for a memorial gathering honoring my dissertation advisor, Joe Duggan, who died about a year ago. He was a specialist in oral traditional literature, particularly French epic poems. He had made a name for himself demonstrating that the French national epic, the Song of Roland, had been composed orally by poets who did not read or write. In the early 1970s, he used a computer to analyze the poem. His office was full of, what do you call them, those key punch cards and big boxes of printouts. It was a big deal. When I started graduate school in the late 1970s, I took a seminar with the visiting scholar in medieval studies who was from Oxford University, J.M. Wallace Hadrill. In his book, The Barbarian West, 400 to 1000, it was a must read, and I confess I was a bit starstruck. Something he said in class made me bring up oral traditional literature and the Song of Roland in particular, and Joe Duggan's work. So fierce was his reaction, you would have thought I had insulted his mother. He was, of course, a very proper aristocratic English gentleman, so his fury was well contained. But it was enough to make me turn red. He said something like, I'm not going to try to do the English accent, I'm sorry, that would just make me seem foolish. No such complex, profound, classic work of literature could have been produced by illiterate peasants. So you may be wondering how this pertains to our topic today, what are we doing to dismantle racism? So it strikes me as a good example of what I'm learning to call white supremacy culture. This is the culture we all share in the United States, regardless of where we live. We experience it just as fish experience the water they live in. This is the culture of our American organizations and institutions, whether or not we who work in those institutions and for those institutions identify personally as white supremacists. It's a different thing. Tema Okun is the author of The Emperor Has No Clothes, Teaching About Race and Racism to People Who Don't Want to Know. As a white person, she can't really ever get out of the water completely. The culture we live in is always present and yet difficult to name or identify. Building on the work of many co-conspirators against racism, she came up with a list of norms and standards characteristic of white supremacy culture. And I'll share a few of them with you. Maybe you can think of others. Perfectionism, a tendency to always look for what's wrong, an inability to analyze and learn from mistakes, not appreciating what's good and right about something, a sense of urgency. It takes time to be inclusive, to make thoughtful decisions, to think long term, to consider consequences, to be truly democratic. Progress and success defined as more or bigger. Serving more people is more important than serving people well. Quantity over quality. The winner is the person who dies with the most toys. The right to comfort. A belief that those in power have a right to psychological and emotional comfort, not understanding that growth and learning often involves discomfort, blaming people who cause discomfort. Defensiveness. Organizational structure protects the status quo. White people spend time defending against the charge of being racist rather than examining how racism may actually be happening, whether or not they're involved with it personally. Belief in only one right way. If others don't see and adapt to the right way, something is wrong with them. Thinking and speaking in absolutes and superlatives. The first, the only, the best, the most. This leaves little room for exploration or new insight. It kind of ends the argument. Paternalism. Those in power often do not think it's important to understand the viewpoint or experience of those for whom they make decisions. People in power believe they know what's best for everybody else. Fear of open conflict. Emphasis on being polite. Whenever someone raises an issue that causes discomfort, the response is to blame the person for raising the issue rather than to look at it. Either or thinking. No sense that things can be both and. Causes oversimplification of complex things like climate change. A need for winners and losers. Objectivity. Belief that emotions are inherently destructive and wrong-headed. Idolatry of logic. Impatience with non-linear thinking and expression. Individualism. Difficulty working in teams. Competition is valued over cooperation. People try to solve problems alone. The common good and general welfare are not priorities. And yes, worship of the written word is also a characteristic of white supremacy culture. Just think of all the missionaries who went and started writing down languages in the places they were colonizing, languages that had had rich oral traditions, but only so that they could translate the Bible into that language. So I wouldn't for a moment suggest there's anything wrong with literacy. I just don't think we should idolize it the way that I believe Professor Wallace Haudrill did. Other modes of communication contribute to strong, healthy relationships and effective teamwork. What does it mean that whether or not something is written down seems more important than the message itself? So I've come to think of, and I was for many years in my previous career a teacher of freshman English. So this is something that's really, you know, internalized by me, that there's one right way to write things and say things and use pronouns and so on. But I've come to think of it more recently as culturally specific rather than a moral value. Think of the distinction between the term illiterate and non-literate or unlettered. In Professor Wallace Haudrill's worldview, the unlettered were clearly considered unworthy. So I'm speaking of white supremacy culture today as part of a teach-in, along with over 200 other Unitarian Universalist congregations. I'm glad to do this in community with hundreds of Unitarian Universalists all over the country, and I trust that this fellowship is committed to the ongoing work of dismantling racism, whether or not other congregations are doing it at the same time or making the same effort. There are many ways in which Unitarian Universalism is the American religion. There were Unitarians and Universalists among the founders, and they brought their values to the table. And there's a book about this by a Unitarian Universalist minister for his church called The American Creed. He writes about how this happened. As an American institution, the Unitarian Universalist Association is just as much a part of the white supremacy culture water we swim in as any other institution. We have been struggling with the gap between our principles and our values on the one hand and our racist practices on the other. We are not unusual in this, of course, and we over the years have more than once resolved to do better as an institution. Last spring, just to catch you up on how the white supremacy teach-in came about, there was a hiring decision made at the UUA that surfaced a deep-seated pattern of discrimination in employment practices. Several resignations followed this, including that of the UUA president, Peter Morales, who just had 3 more months in his 8-year term. It was a big upset for the association last spring. If you were here, maybe you remember hearing about it. The board appointed a trio of well-known and respected African-American leaders as interim presidents, and in June, the General Assembly elected the UUA's first woman president, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. And this was a foregone conclusion because all of the candidates happened to be women this time around. We were ready for that. I am hopeful that as an institution, we are doing better. And how are we doing as individuals? Speaking for myself, I can say that every time I think I've got it, that I'm finally woke, I learn something new. Just last week, I learned how complicated desegregation was, how many good black schools were closed, and how many African-American teachers lost their jobs. Since the white supremacist rallies in Charlottesville in August and the death of Heather Heyer, I've learned that most of the Confederate monuments currently in dispute were erected in the early 20th century, about 35 years after the end of the Civil War. Reconstruction had collapsed, and Jim Crow laws were being implemented to disenfranchise newly freed African Americans. The purpose of the monuments was not to honor the dead, but to assert so-called states' rights ideology. Just about every day, I reach a new insight about my own white privilege. As my colleague, Reverend Galen Gingrich, has said, and it's not spelled the same way, privilege is what you don't have to think about. This is why I wear this bracelet, so that I will think about it. I may not feel the privilege, so I have to be intentional to actually learn the effects of my white privilege on people of color. So let us engage in justice-making practices consistent with the promise of our values and our principles. Let us join with others who have the same aspirations. Let us keep on learning, advocating, and showing up. Let us practice together and with love. I close with these words from Tema Okun, from her book, The Emperor Has No Clothes. She writes, "I am more clear than I have ever been that the race construct diminishes me even while it privileges me. I am more clear than I have ever been that I am both racist and anti-racist at the same time. I am more clear than I have ever been that the collective, collaborative struggle for a more just world is both never enough and its own reward. I am more clear than I have ever been that the road to justice is paved with love. So may it be.